Well, good evening and welcome to the Culinary Historians of Chicago. This is our 30th year. This year we're celebrating our 30th year of existence. We've done hundreds of programs over the years with incredible speakers. We have a number of incredible speakers coming up monthly, and Kathy Lambert, who you just heard from, has her sister group, Chicago Foodways Roundtable, and she has a number of programs coming up. Don't even try to tell us apart. We're sister or brother organizations, and Kathy does a wonderful job with her organization, with her stuff. You'll see us all our programs on the web, on our website. And I'm going to get right to our program tonight. We have Colleen Sen speaking. Colleen has been a friend of mine for, I think, over 30 years, and I forget how prominent she is in the culinary writing field. And let me tell you this about her, what she's going to speak on tonight. Well, let me start out like this. How does a Canadian woman with a PhD in Slavic languages, who makes her home in Rogers Park on Chicago's North Side, become one of the world's authorities on Indian cuisine and food history? You're going to find out tonight when Colleen Sen dishes on the stories in her soon-to-be-published work, The New Bloomsbury Handbook of Indian Cuisine. Colleen was one of three editors of this massive 450-page work that has more than 200 entries written by leading food writers in India and abroad. The entries cover city and state cuisines, famous restaurants, iconic dishes, food and medicine, cooking utensils, and more. Everything you ever could want to know about Indian cuisine and food history. Kathy, what were we gonna, I'm sorry with my, I had too much curry in my brain tonight. What were we gonna say about ordering the book or where the book?
You know what, I'll put information in the chat.
That's right. Oh, and Kathy.
That'll be far easier.
Yes, Kathy will put information in the chat about the Bloomsbury Handbook of Indian Cuisine. And anyway, you can see that. And also regarding chat, if you have questions for Colleen, and we encourage you to ask questions, please do them through chat. And you can start putting the questions in now if you want. But Kathy will read the questions to Colleen after the program, after Colleen gives her presentation. Anyway, in the past 30 years, Colleen has presented maybe 10 programs before the Culinary Historians of Chicago. She's one of our most prolific, I was gonna say one of our most promiscuous, but that's the wrong word, one of our most prolific presenters. And she's a prolific author and editor. She has contributed freelance articles to such publications as Travel and Leisure, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Chicago Tribune, and she was a regular participant in the Oxford Symposia on Food and Cookery. This lady gets around. She's written 8 books, just among them, Food Culture in India, Curry, A Global Dish, A Global History, and Feasts and Fasts, A History of Food in India. And she's done a major thing for our local food writing scene. In 2017, Colleen co-edited the Chicago Food Encyclopedia. Her books have been translated into Arabic, Japanese, Korean, and Chinese. She has also organized many culinary tours of Indian stores. I've taken her tours around Devon Avenue, and she's given talks and cooking demonstrations on Indian cuisine. And Colleen has appeared on talk shows in India. Her books are really hot sellers in India, and she's so well known there to the point where she can walk down the street in India and people stop her for her autograph. I don't think they do that for her in Rogers Park. You know, they don't know what a treasure they've got there. But anyway, Colleen, we'd like to curry your favor and ask you to come up and come on down and dish out your tale for us.
Oh, Scott, thank you for that more than generous introduction. Yeah, I'm always really pleased to be invited to speak to the culinary historians in Chicago Foodways. And, you know, I've known both of you for so long. And so this is always really fun for me. So so this book, it has come out. It came out last month. And there's a cover of it there. And Scott has already said a little bit about it, that it has 450 pages and the entries range in length from 75 to 4,000 words. And we have more than 25 contributors in India, US and Europe. And these are some of the topics that are covered. It's the first book of its kind since K.T. Achaya's A Historical Dictionary of Indian Food, which appeared in 1998. And this is a wonderful work. And it's really, Achaya was a food chemist, and he also knew Sanskrit. So his book is can be very technical. There's a lot about the area that he grew up in, but we've tried to be a little bit more comprehensive, and we've tried to cover the food of every Indian state. There are now 24 of them, the major cities, main communities, dishes, ingredients, personalities, and so on. You can see the list here. I mean, with a country like India, this is impossible. I mean, Carol Haddock's Bruce and I, Craig and I, did the Chicago Food Encyclopedia, which is on one city of, what, 8 million. And this is a book maybe slightly bigger on a country of over 1 billion. So obviously, you know, we really tried to just hit the high points. But I'd like to say a little bit about its origin. It came, Sodish Bhattacharya is a very well-known Indian food writer, and he's written and he's been a critic and so on. So about 5 years ago at a conference in Delhi, he said, you know, I'd really like to do a kind of a modern version of Achaya, an encyclopedia of Indian food. And I said, say no more, because 15 years ago, Helen Sabari, and Helen, who I met at the Oxford Food Symposium, she's a very well-known writer. She was Ellen Davidson's assistant on the very first Oxford Companion of Food. She's written books on Afghan food. She's a specialist on tea. And she and I actually had a proposal to do the Companion of Indian Food. We had an agent, we submitted to Oxford University Press, they were very excited, it went all the way up, they sent us a contract, we were about ready to sign, and then Oxford killed the whole series. So this proposal was kind of sitting there. So, I mean, in a sense, it was just, we had to really bring it up to date. In a way, I'm glad we didn't do it then, because one major difference between now and 15 years ago is the proliferation of writers in India who write seriously about Indian food, and not just recipes and recipe books and my grandmother's, who really write about the history of the food. And like someone wrote a 400-page book on the food of Calcutta. They write articles about dishes, about their historical origins. So there's really a community of food writers now in India that we could draw upon. And we were able to do that and recruit them for the book. So for example, someone who wrote about this Hyderabad was the leading food writer in Hyderabad and knew the city backwards and forwards. Same thing with some of the states. And some of these states have never been written about. So there's really some really original things in there. I would say that Helen Sodish and I probably wrote between a quarter and a third of it ourselves, because there were some topics that, you know, we didn't find people. I wrote many of the articles that were very general because I've written about the history of Indian food. So it really was a collaborative effort. It did take about 3 years to do it. And as I said, it came out. Now, okay, one thing is this book was intended for academic libraries, which means it's very expensive. And I'm not trying to sell the book here. I mean, Catherine, if you contact her, she can make an arrangement. She can get, you know, she's got with the publisher, she can tell you what it is. But if you'd like to read it, I really suggest that you just go to your library and ask to purchase the book. And this is the form from the Chicago Public Library. You how to order a book, you sign in, put your stuff in, and then you see down here, suggest a purchase. Whoops, sorry. And where it says suggest a purchase, you can put in the name, the author, the name. And if two or three people do it, there's a good chance that they'll buy the book. And that would be really, really a good way of doing it. And they sometimes ask for the ISBN number, which I put here. So again, Catherine, if you want to put that in your chatter, or maybe people can find it if people do want to order it, because I don't expect people to, you know, pay that kind of money for it. So so the book has some things that people know, but there's a lot of things that I think are kind of innovative and that people may not really generally be familiar with. And this is the first one. So the question is, what cuisine is this? And these are some of the components. Okay, so the main ingredients: soybeans, bamboo shoots, dried fish, black rice, pork, beef, silkworm, pupae, ant eggs. The food is mainly non-vegetarian. Rice is the staple. And this cuisine, these cuisines, I should say, use few or no spices. The use of green herbs and the world's hottest chilies. They make minimal use of oil. Common methods of cooking are steaming, wrapping in leaves, roasting, smoking, and fermentation. Sometimes tea is eaten as a vegetable, and alcoholic beverages are very common and brewed from rice and barley. And this is a picture of this is. And what this cuisine is, this is actually, it's called the cuisine of the Seven Sisters. And the Seven Sisters are seven states in Northeast India. And you can see them here. And 95% of these states' borders are not with India. They're with China, Myanmar, Bangladesh, and Bhutan. And the largest here you can see is Assam, which is kind of this wandering seat. But then you have Arunachal Pradesh, Nagaland, Manipur, Mizoram, Tripura, and Meghalaya. And here you have Sikkim, which is part of India, to a separate state. And it's sometimes called the Eighth Brother. But the Seven Sisters is what these states are known of. Now, they're not, but far from homogeneous, there's hundreds and hundreds of tribes in these states, and they have their own identities, their own languages, their own religions. They have a lot of similarities with Burma, with Myanmar. They tend to be Asian, and they're all very different. The area itself, it's very heavily forest. The rainfall is moderate to extreme. In fact, one place has the highest rainfall in the world. There's very rich biodiversity. Agriculture is the main activity. And what's interesting is there's a very large Christian population here, especially in Nagaland. And Nagaland is this state here. And you can see it borders on Myanmar. It's got all these states border on Myanmar. And until the 50s, some of the Naga tribes were headhunters. And you can still see pictures of them displaying their heads. And then missionaries came here and converted them. But English is widely spoken. And in fact, I think English is probably the state language of Nagaland and maybe another state as well. And the interesting thing about this is tea was discovered in Assam in 1840. This really gave rise to the Indian tea industry, since the British were really dependent on the Chinese for tea. This led to the Opium War and other problems. So this was kind of an interesting part that it was discovered here. Now, here you can see a picture of me taken a few years ago. I visited Upper Assam, which is here. And I visited, and this was members of a tribe called the Xingpo tribe. Now, the Xingpos they're kind of cross border. Some live in Myanmar, some live in China, and some live in Assam. The man in the center, and you can see his dress looks very quite Chinese. He was the chief of this tribe. And on the right was his son, who I guess the son is the heir, and who's studying in Delhi. And their house was made totally of bamboo. You can see here it was bamboo, but also the floor, the chairs, everything is bamboo. And you had to walk across these kind of bamboo. You had to go upstairs and walk across these bamboo planks to get there. It was quite an experience. And then the other picture here is the kitchen. And you can see they're cooking. And you can see there's no deep, you don't see a lot of deep fat, which you see in other cuisines. There's a lot of steaming. This is the leaves they're wrapping things in. They're charring things. So it's really quite a different cuisine. But still, this is part of India. And we can't say that Indian cuisine is a lot of spices, Indian cuisine is this, because these are seven states of India where none of this is true. The famous chili, at one time it was the world's hottest chili, is the ghost chili of Assam. I think there's a competition. I think it may have been nudged from first place, but a lot of the very hot chilies in the world are descended from this, and they certainly use it in some of their dishes. So that's the first thing I wanted to point out. Oh, and these are some dishes from there. The left one is a meal from Nagaland, which this is dried fish and there's rice. This looks like there's chilies in it and various side dishes. This is a kind of cheese called churpi cheese, which is made from yak milk. It's kind of a dry cheese. This is pork wrapped in a local leaf and steamed. And this is very interesting. This is tea smoked in a bamboo tube. And actually, I bought one of these tubes back with me. I surprised I got through customs. And I think I have some. And it has a very nice smoky flavor. And they also use tea as a salad. And if you've ever been to a Burmese restaurant, sometimes there they'll have tea leaves as a salad. I think there was a Rohingya restaurant on Devon, and they used to have this tea leaf salad. So they made a lot of use of tea, but they weren't really growing it as for a drink in the way that we drink it now. That was something that the British eventually did. Now, the next thing I want to talk to is what I say is India's most popular ethnic cuisine. And it's the second most popular dining out option in India. I think the first is probably tandoori chicken and that sort of thing. And these are restaurants that you find that are located mainly in the big cities, Kolkata, Mumbai, Delhi. And they owed their origin back probably to the 19th century. The British Governor General invited in the late 18th century a trader to come from China to establish a sugar plantation. And so a Chinese community, which were mainly Hakkas, started growing in and around Calcutta. And another wave of Chinese came when they started growing tea in Assam, because they needed labor to work the tea plantations, and they also needed Chinese expertise. So a large community arose in Kolkata in a neighborhood called Tangra. But today, the Chinese population has actually dwindled to a very small minority. And there's a couple of reasons for this. And one was after the Indo-Chinese War in 1962, some people, they were confined and they were viewed with suspicion. So a lot of these Indian Chinese migrated to Canada, especially into Australia. But wherever they went, they took this food with them. Now, what is, and in Chicago, this food is also popular here. And there's a restaurant on Devon called Usmania. I think Usmani Chinese, it's across the street from the other Usmania. You have one called, what's it called? Something Chopsticks in Naperville, I'll think about it, Arlington Heights maybe. And then you know Rohini Day, who had a Vermilion restaurant. She has just converted it from a Latin Indian fusion to one of these Chinese Indian restaurants. So if you want to try it, it's certainly near at hand. There's others in the Chicago area. So these are some of the popular dishes, and the characteristics of this food are they use a lot of kikkoman soy sauce. They use a green chili sauce. They have a lot of deep fried things with batters. They use and they have thick gravies. They use a lot of red chilies. It can be very spicy. These sauces are kind of red often, these red sauce. They use a lot of garlic, a lot of ginger. And so for vegetarians, they make the dishes with paneer and cauliflower. And so there's five dishes that are often associated with this cuisine. And I'll just tell you a little bit about them. The first is this man chow soup, and it's made with various vegetables, with green onions and chicken. It has a broth, and it's thickened with corn flour and a lot of soy sauce and ginger, as well as garlic, chilies, and sauce. And it's often served with crispy fried noodles, which you can see on top. The one on the right is lollipop chicken, or chicken lollipop, I'm not sure which it is. And basically, it's a little winglet of chicken fattened to a ball, coated with a spicy red batter, and it's deep fried, and it's served on the bone to give it the appearance of a lollipop. In the middle, you have Hakka noodles, which is basically wheat noodles that are boiled and then topped with stir-fried vegetables, soy sauce, and a hot sauce. And this is a very popular street food dish. You see this served often all over India, and it's really popular. And Indian students especially love these dried noodles. It's kind of a standard, that they add water to, a standard student there. And then you have two other dishes. The one at the top is chicken 65. And this is chicken, this is really common. You'll find this everywhere, even in non-Chinese Indian restaurants. It's basically chicken pieces on the bone that are deep fried and doused with red chili and black pepper. And I think they're kind of dry. There's not really much of a sauce with there. And this one has a few peas. Now, where does this name come from? Well, nobody's really sure for so. It was actually invented by a guy named Mr. Wang. And no, not by Mr. Wang. It was invented in Madras in Chennai by a man named Buhari. And he apparently added this dish to the restaurant menu after he served it at a New Year's party on the last day of 1965. So some people say that's where it comes from. Some people say it may have been, the recipe may call for 65 ingredients, but that's not true. Another joke is that 65-day-old chicken is used for it. That's not it either. So there's a lot of explanations about chicken 65, but you'll find that practically everywhere you go. And the other one is chicken Manchurian, but here I've called it gobi cauliflower Manchurian because this would be a vegetarian main. And it's in a thick cornflour batter, deep fried, and then served in a hot sauce made with soy sauce, vinegar, onions, chilies, and garlic. And it was created by a restaurant owner called Nelson Wang in Mumbai in 1970s. And again, the name is a mystery because Manchuria, was a region in North China that was controlled by the Japanese during the war. So probably he just added it because it sounded kind of exotic. And that's why it's called that. Now, just to go to another thing, as I mentioned, the book has a lot of profiles of different personalities. And some of them are these iconic cookbook writers. And this is probably the most famous of all. And her name is Mrs. Balbir Singh. I don't know what her first name is. You can see the title. She always calls herself Mrs. Balbir Singh. And she wrote this book, Indian Cookery, in 1961. Mother Joffrey has called it probably one of the finest, called it one of the finest Indian cookbooks ever written. It's gone through dozens and dozens of editions. And it's really the first cookbook that gave very precise and detailed instructions on how to prepare Indian dishes. And it came, Mrs. Balbir Singh in the 50s, she started out by in Delhi with the breakup of the joint families where, you know, brides would move in with their mothers-in-law. There was kind of a lack of the tradition going that people, the dishes would pass to mother or mother-in-law down. And so there was a need for cooking classes. So Mrs. Balbir Singh started doing these cooking classes in Delhi, and they became incredibly popular. Everyone took them, famous people, you know, wives of diplomats. And then she eventually, I think at some point she moved to London with her husband and wrote this book. But at some point they came back to India and she hosted the very first cooking show on Indian TV. So I just want to show, and this is a book when my husband and I came to Chicago, there weren't that many Indian cookbooks. And I think we had two that we used. One was this Indian Cookery and the other was really the diametric opposite. It's called Indian Cooking by Veera Swami. And there is really no Veera Swami. It's a fictional name. And those recipes are real simple and basic. Anyone could make them. But this book, and I'll show you one of her recipes. So this is for an almond kebab curry. So you can see that the ingredients. Okay, so there's one, two, three. There's six separate listings of the different ingredients that have to be added at different stages. And then here's the method, one, two, three, four. And this is not an easy thing to make. And you notice the measurements are very careful. She's not just saying, you know, a pinch of this and so on. And this isn't even one of the longer recipes. Some of them are really long, but it's a really good book. And if you're serious about Indian cooking, you can always get a secondhand copy on, AB Books or somewhere else. These are just a few other cookbook pioneers that we profiled in the book. Meenakshi Amal, she wrote a book called, in the English version is Cook and See. And actually she is the expert on Tamil cooking. And she was widowed at a very young age and she had to support her family. And she started cooking all these vegetarian Tamil recipes. And so there's two volumes, and she even uses these old Indian measurements, like instead of cups and pints, she uses tolas and things like that. So it's quite a quaint book. Her granddaughter has issued a more up-to-date version that is easier for us to use. But her book, again, just became the go-to book for every young Tamil housewife who got married, especially those who had to leave, who go out of the state and had no resources. So this was really essential. Mrs. Matthew here, has a similar position for the cuisine of Kerala, which is in the southeast. And a long time ago, Bruce Craig and his wife went to India and actually interviewed Mrs. Matthew and for a video they were doing. And again, she wrote she was very well connected. I think one of her relatives owned a newspaper in Kerala. She started writing for the columns. And then eventually she did this book, which is called Carol of Cookery. And again, I used to use that a lot at one point. It's not vegetarian. She has fish recipes. The recipes call for a lot of coconut milk. And again, if you're interested in that, it's a good book to have. Now, Pragya Sundari Devi, she wrote a book on Bengali cuisine. Bengali is this the far east, and it was written only in Bengali, and she kind of was the first to really try to codify some of these recipes for housewives. So instead of, you know, just kind of going by trial and error, she actually systematized them. She was related to the Tagore family, and one of the things she did is she would prepare menus for the meals of the Tagore family. So she'd list what they would have in every meal, which was kind of an innovation. This lady here, Santarama Rao, she's an American, but she wrote the Indian cookbook. She lived in America for the Time Life series. You may remember that wonderful series of books. And she really was quite early in doing that. I don't know if she preceded Madhu Jaffrey. No, she wrote in 1969. So that was really one of the first cookbooks that she did. And she was the daughter of a diplomat who had lived in New York and lived all over the world, and has wonderful pictures, as though that series did. And finally, on the right, we have Tarla Dalal. And she has written hundreds of cookbooks, hundreds, literally hundreds. She started, again, she couldn't cook. She got married, and her husband was more traveled, and he started asking her to make certain Western dishes, and she didn't know how. So she kind of taught herself. And so her cookbooks are almost all vegetarian, but she has books on salads, on Chinese food, they're all vegetarian. And she had tons of cooking shows on TV. And she really is probably the best known cookbook writer there is in India. And she had a show, Cook It Up with Tarla Dalal. And she has a website, tarladalal.com, which has around 17,000 recipes. So if you're interested in finding some vegetarian recipes, I don't know if she has millet recipes. I should check that. This is for something else. But she does have a lot of recipes there. So these are just a few of the pioneers that wrote books. Now, again, we talked about iconic restaurants, and this is an interesting one. It was called the Maxim's of the East in Firpo's. And in the 20s and 30s, 40s, even up to the 50s, Calcutta had a great nightlife. There were a lot of nightclubs, and this was probably the most famous. And it was opened in 1917 by Angelo Firpo, who I think was Swiss, a Swiss-Italian. And anybody who was anybody in Calcutta went to this place, including the viceroy. It was famous for its menus. It was famous for its cocktails, including the balloon cosmopolitan. I don't know what it is. In Vikram Seth's novel, A Suitable Boy, it's often mentioned. And you can see a picture of here. It was very lavish. And also, this is a typical menu. And you can see this had this was a luncheon menu, and this had very Western foods. But dinner would have both curries and Western food and Indian food as well. Now, what's interesting about this, Merle Oberon, the actress, was discovered here in 1918. And you probably have seen her in movies like Wuthering Heights, and she was considered a great beauty in the 30s, 40s, 50s. And actually, she always said she was from Tasmania. But in fact, she was a member of the Anglo-Indian community, and the Anglo-Indians were descendants of British and Indian women. And these weren't British like the aristocrats. These were like railway workers, British soldiers, and things like that. And they formed a distinct community, and they were rather looked down upon by both Indians and British. Most of them, after Indian independence, emigrated to Canada, and especially Australia. If you go to Australia, you meet quite a few. I recognize the distinctive accent they have. So her name was Estelle Merle O'Brien Thompson, and she was very beautiful. And one story is she was in Firpo's when she was kind of discovered. She had various menial jobs there. I think maybe she was a waitress. I'm not sure exactly. But she always denied her Indian heritage. She never admitted this. And you know, people in the books later trace this. And one time she was supposed to go to Tasmania, and the last minute she said she was sick. She didn't go. But this is just an interesting part of history that about probably India's most famous film star in the West. Now, this is something that one of your previous speakers have handled. I said we mentioned ingredients, and these are lichens. And lichens are kind of a cross between an algae, between algae and fungi, and they grow on certain trees and or rocks. And most of them come from the Himalayas, and they're sold by the local tribal people. And one popular variety is called stone flower, which is so pretty. And you don't find it very often, but you can buy it in Patel Brothers. And it's a main ingredient in certain regional spice blends. And it's especially used in meat dishes such as biryani. And it has kind of an earthy, smoky flavor and an aroma when heated. And Priya Mani, who you may remember, who's one of our main contributors to the Indian Companion, she gave a talk some time ago to you. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Indian Jewish food. There were once tens of thousands of Indians of Jews in India, but most of them emigrated to Israel after independence, and now there's only a few thousand. There's never been any anti-Semitism in India, so they didn't really leave because of discrimination, but I think they just felt they wanted to be in a Jewish community. And there were five separate groups of Jews in India, and they came at different times. There was the Cochin Jews in the West Coast, and they may have come following the destruction of the Second Temple. That's one theory about their arrival. There's Jews in Chennai, which was Madras. There's Jews in Goan, and I think they came somewhat later, the 12th century. There's a so-called Baghdadi Jews who came 18th and 19th century, and they were very wealthy in Kolkata. And the Sassoon family, which is a name you know, well, through many ways, they had a branch in Kolkata. And then there were the Bene Israel Jews in Western India, in Mumbai and Maharashtra. And they're probably the most numerous now in India. So these different communities, they merged with the local communities, they adopted their food habits, but they prayed in Hebrew and they maintained their dietary laws. So there was no mixing of dairy and meat, no pork, no shellfish, no fish without sales. But many of them ate fish, and some were vegetarian even when kosher meat isn't available. And you know, sweets are very, very popular in India. Sweets are usually made with milk and sugar, but they would end their meal with sweets made with coconut milk or fruit so as not to mix dairy with meat in the same meal. And these are a couple of these beautiful synagogues. This is one in Mumbai that's been beautifully preserved. And this is another one in Pune, and this is in Western India. And if you go online, you can see the interiors. They're just gorgeous, these synagogues. So the Bene Israel Jews, these are the ones that we covered really in the companion, and so these are just a couple of dishes that they would have on holidays. On Rosh Hashanah, they would offer prayers by the sea, and they would eat halwa. And here's a halwa that would be made with wheat gluten that mixed with coconut milk. This sugar and cardamom, and this is one mixed with saffron, and this is a picture of their halwa. On Purim, sour and sweet dishes were made. They observed a fast, and the fast would be broken by eating a few raw birdi, which are these field beans, and it would end with a feast of these birdis, which are these field beans cooked with coconut and puris, which is the bread. And I don't know why these beans were used. And Shiva ends with a community feast. And the same again, beer day is served. And this is what they do. And mourning families eat the end of Shiva by consuming a fig, a banana, and a glass of milk. So these are just some of the customs observed by one community. Now, Esther David has just come out with a new book, Bene Appetit, The Cuisine of Indian Jews. And I think this sounds really interesting. So anyone who's interested, I don't know if it's actually out yet. I was looking for it. And I suggested to Scott and Catherine that if they can get her to speak, I think it'd be very interesting. And then there's this website I found, an Architectural Digest, had a very nice illustrated picture of the feasts on the holy days in Mumbai. So that may be something you'd like to look at. Now, this is something I've talked about before, something that is one of my pet bugaboos, is this business of mogul food. And you know, if you go to any Indian restaurant, they'll have some mogul dishes or Mughlai dishes. And these are typically, things like biryani. They're kind of like meat cooked with yogurt, meat cooked in a gravy, various kebabs. And there's nothing particularly Mughal about these dishes, because the Mughals were this grand dynasty that ruled. They originally came from Central Asia, and they ruled India from 1526 to 1858. And they built the Taj Mahal and other members and other buildings, you know, about Shah Jahan and Jahangir. And this is a picture of one of them having a feast and things like that. So what this is, it's a kind of a catch-all phrase that's used to for rich, often meat-based North Indian dishes that are associated with the Muslim community. And now everyone eats them, but I think people just don't want to say that. So basically it means North Indian Muslim cooking. So it's kind of a misnomer. And often these dishes have names like Chicken Shah Jahan or Pulao Nur Mahal or things like that that they've made up. And actually, if you look at what the Mughals actually ate, they really, we do have some record of it. And some of the dishes are like this, but really this was originally they came from Central Asia. Their first dishes were really very Central Asian, kind of bland and things like that. So this is really a term used by some enterprising restaurant owner just to give some cachet to his dish. And as proof of that, I will show you this. This is one of these wonderful G-grams. I don't know if you ever use these that Google has. And what it is, it tracks the N-gram. So it maps the number of citations in books, magazines, and newspapers between 1800 and the present. So you want to see if a term is in use. So for example, you can see about 1950, there was a little peak. Somebody started calling their cuisine Mughal. I don't know who. And then it went down, and then it came up, and then it came up, and now it's become kind of common. And just to show you that it's not something that existed historically, it's something that really was a term created just to make their food look more fancy than it actually is. And I wish they would just call dishes by their names and not have to do this fancy thing. Now, the final thing I want to address is this issue: are most Indians vegetarians? And I think most people think they are. But this is really not true. And only 39% of all Indians describe themselves as vegetarians. And this varies by religion. Now, 90% of Jains, and I'm surprised it's not 100%, because Jains are the most vegetarian group in the world. I think this is a bit off. 44% of Hindus, 8% of Muslims, which surprised me, and 10% of Christians describe themselves as vegetarians. But you can see that if you look at by state, the highest number of vegetarians are here in Rajasthan. And this is, Rajasthan is a great desert, it's rather a poor state, and much of it is desert. And they don't even grow very much there. So their vegetarian cuisine is very innovative. They use things from trees and pods, and they, but there's a very high rate there. Next is Gujarat. And you know, in Chicago, a lot of people of Indian descent are Gujarati. You find names like Patel is a Gujarati name, and they tend to be mainly vegetarian. Now we have to remember that these states are mixed populations, so they would have some Muslims who wouldn't be vegetarian and so on. But on Devon Avenue, if you want a vegetarian meal, you can go to Annapurna, which serves kind of Gujarati vegetarian food. Another high thing is Haryana, which always surprises people, because it's kind of, I don't know why that is. One reason may be that they're very great milk drinkers, so maybe they don't need meat so much. And the Punjab also is very heavily vegetarian. And you can see these states here. Now, the other extreme are states like Bengal, where my husband is from, 1.4% are vegetarian. So hardly anyone in Bengal is vegetarian. And Kerala, which is down here, is 3%. Now, I can see Kerala because there's a lot of Christians in Kerala, but nonetheless, I think these two states have a lot of other things in common too. And certainly eating meat is one of them. Odisha next door has 2.6, Telangana, these states here. And I could go into more detail about why I think these states aren't do eat meat. There's many reasons, but I think it's interesting just to see the variation. So you really can't say that all Indians are vegetarian. And this is the Northeast I spoke about earlier. It just shows you, you can see what a tiny link it has with India. Just this little link here, these seven sisters. And most of those aren't vegetarian. More women than men tend to be vegetarians. And vegetarian diet is very common during Hindu fasts. So when people fast, they would, and their fasts aren't really that extreme. Some people, I mean, they maybe just eat fruit. During fasts, some people avoid eating wheat and rice, and they'll have breads made of chestnut powder, and it's really quite delicious. And so the people would fast maybe more at that time. What's interesting is very few Indians are vegans. I mean, however much of a vegetarian you are, milk, dairy products, yogurt, paneer, which is the cheese, you know, the hard cheese, is, you know, would be part of your diet. So I think that's a very important factor. And finally, beef is taboo for most Hindus. Not all Hindus. I mean, in other Bengal and Kerala, people eat beef, other parts of India. But basically, it's a very sensitive political issue. And I read a very interesting survey that asked members of different religions in India what it means to be like a Muslim, a Christian, a Hindu, and so on. And one of the things that they asked is eating beef. And more Hindus said that to be a Hindu, you had to eat beef than said to be a Hindu, you had to believe in God. In other words, you could be, and you didn't have to go to the temple. So it's really become a marker of Hinduism in India, and especially with the politics of India today, it's become associated with certain political groups. And you know, I think cow slaughter is banned in certain states, not all of them, but that is something that that is controversial. So finally, I think my conclusion is that there really is no such thing as Indian food. I've already looked at some of the things that are diverse. You have the Northeast, you have these different communities, you have people who are veg, you have people who are non-veg. India is a vast country of many languages and dialects, 8 major religions, many minor religions, countless tribes, countless social groups. It has a very wide range of climates, from the Himalayas to the desert, to the Northeast, to the South. And it's more diverse than Europe in every respect. But we don't talk about European food. We don't say, oh, let's go out for a European meal, which would sound silly. And yet we do that with Indian food. I think the problem is, well, it's a very complex issue. I think part of the responsibility lies with restaurant owners trying to educate the public, maybe people like me trying to tell people about the diversity. And I think the restaurant scene in Chicago certainly is getting a lot more interesting. You have a lot of really nice new restaurants coming up. You had Rue, you had Vasant, you now have Andien, which is just with a very famous chef with us, you know, prefix menu, small plates. He's probably going to get a Michelin star when it comes out. And so I think this is elevating Indian food to the level it deserves. And then you also have some small regional restaurants too, but you have to kind of search them out. Like when we go out for Indian food, we live near Devon Avenue, who incidentally was an Indian when we moved here. But there's all these small Hyderabadi restaurants, kind of north of, east of Western. There's Hyderabad House, there's Naan Roti, there's ones in the side street, and they have this very rich meaty cuisine. They have biryanis, they have kebabs, and those places are fun to try out. And, you know, they're very casual. There's a lot of taxi drivers, students go there. But if you're willing to explore a little bit, then there really are treasures to be found in Devon Avenue as well that isn't the standard, the big three, tandoori chicken, samosa, sagir pan. I suggest they be banned from restaurant menus, but I don't think it's going to happen. And the other thing is that really there's so many commonalities between Indian food and the food of Pakistan, Nepal, and Bangladesh, you really can't separate them. I mean, there are some dishes that you'd find, I mean, Bengali and Bangladeshi food has so many features in common. Punjabi, you know, there's a Punjab province in Pakistan, there's one in India. The food is virtually identical. I mean, obviously, you know, beef and pork are issues, but this it's really a continuum between the neighboring countries and India. And the, finally, the thing is, there's no Indian national dish. Last year, a couple of years ago, the Indian government wanted to create a say, what's the Indian national dish? We have to have something, you know, that we can proclaim. Well, they couldn't do it. I mean, everybody had suggestions, and then people would get upset, and then they would argue. I think the closest they came was biryani, which is, a rich meat and rice dish. But then there's so many varieties. People said, no, it's our biryani. No, it's ours. So they abandoned the whole idea. So I think this kind of gives you an idea of how diverse Indian food is and how you really can't pin it down. So that's the end of my talk, and I'd be happy to have any questions. Thank you.
But one question I had, or an observation I had, within the last 10 years, I went to a special dinner at Vermilion. That's the restaurant you mentioned that Rohini Day owns, the fusion Indian food, and Mater Jaffrey was the speaker for that special event. And she was talking about how wonderful Indian food was. And I told her my experience when I was a kid. You know, I grew up in Chicago, and I told her that she had actually explained why I hated Indian food so much when I was growing up. I only tasted it a few times. I can still remember the horrible, I have a good taste memory, and I still have that horrible taste in my mouth from some of the Indian food that I had in the restaurants in Chicago. And Mater Jaffrey had explained that Indian food in the restaurants was just terrible. She said, we don't eat like that in India. And I thanked her for explaining why I thought Indian food was so bad, because it was in the restaurants. And I've had Indian cooking classes, and I've eaten now in some wonderful restaurants. It's such a wonderful food, but what a terrible first impression that was. Or do you have any comment about the evolution?
Yeah, it used to be pretty standard. I think you can get some authentic Indian food. I mean, I mentioned these Hyderabad restaurants. Those are pretty authentic and Indian food. And I mean, it may not be to everyone's taste, because they can be a little bit spicy. But I really don't think Indian food is, this idea that Indian food is hot, again, I think it's another myth. I probably should have put that in here, because it really depends on the family. I mean, in my husband's family, the food wasn't hot at all. Other people's house maybe. And generally, restaurants try to damp things down. I mean, they don't, especially for Western patrons, they don't, do it at all. And I think there's some good Indian restaurants. I mean, Indian, Indian Essence in Devon, and the Indian Harvest out in Naperville, and now these new ones that are coming up. And yeah, I think it's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah, now it is, but I guess I'm talking about in the 50s.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely, yeah.
Putrid. But, and you've introduced me some wonderful Indian restaurants in your tours and having dinner with you. And the other question, the remaining question that I have for you is, how on earth does a nice Canadian lady with a name like Colleen, how on earth did you get into Indian cooking and becoming such an authority? Now, there's a little spoiler here. I see two of the reasons in our audience that why you got into Indian food and food writing. And one is your husband, Ashish Sen, who's here. I just want to mention, if he's your trophy husband, because Ashish is quite distinguished, right? What, he worked for President Clinton, is that correct?
Yes.
And can you tell what he did? What's
my
line?
He was head of one of the federal agencies. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the other one, Carol Haddix. I'm going to embarrass you, Carol. You worked quite a bit with Carol, writing for the Tribune, and co-editing with her the Chicago Food Encyclopedia, along with Bruce Craig. But again, Carol is the retired, distinguished, longtime retired editor of the Chicago Tribune's food section. So hi, Carol, it's good seeing you tonight. But these people had quite an impact on your career. So
anyway, absolutely. Yeah, thank you. That's absolutely true. Well, you know, and I think I started doing freelancing. You know, I always had a full-time job, but I just started writing about in my husband's mother, late mother, was a very well-known writer in India. She had her own column. She had her own publication. She wrote a lot about food. So he kind of encouraged me to follow in her footsteps. So I just started writing about, you know, things like new restaurants that would open or new communities. I did one in Kerala Food. And of course, Carol was always so receptive and open to new ideas that, you know, I would call her up and say, would you like this? And she'd say yes or no. And it was really great to be able to do that. So I wrote an awful lot of restaurant articles for the Tribune and also for the Sun Times as well. So I was just writing about it when nobody else really was. You know, people were maybe doing recipes, but really it was just that and I'm really interested in kind of the cultural and historical aspects of food. That's really what kind of my forte is. And so I just got there at the right time. And when I wrote my first books, there weren't that many being written. So it worked out well.
The right niche at the right time.
Yeah.
And also, but I mean, you know, you have a doctorate in Slavic languages. You went to school in New York. What school did you go to? Where did you go to graduate school?
Oh, well, I went to Columbia. But the Russian, actually, the way it came in handy, this is really funny. The very first food piece I ever wrote, and the very it was for Travel and Leisure magazine. And, before, at one point when there was an exodus of Soviet Jews, there were at least four Russian restaurants and grocery stores on Devon Avenue. And so I thought, and since I knew Russian, I thought, well, I'd like to write about that. So I gave a pitch to Travel and Leisure. I said, would you like an article on Russian food in North Chicago? And they said, yeah, this is great. Well, what happened was, you know, what happens with everybody always moves. So everybody moved to Skokie. And by the time the article came out a year later, there was only one place left. And they ran the article, but it didn't make any sense at all by then because there was nothing hardly left. So there was really, and you know, as you know, Devon Avenue was originally very Jewish. And when we moved in, it had just started making the transition to being more South Asian.
Great. And Kathy is going to do chat with us for your chat questions. So take it away, Kathy.
Okay, great. So I'll just start with actually the last question because it kind of makes sense. Annette Lane said, gotta ask, what's wrong with samosas? I think of an Indian restaurant in Atlanta that catered mostly to Desi food and specializes in them.
They're good. I mean, they're nice. They're snack foods. They go with tea. They go great with drinks. I mean, I think cocktails and Indian food are a great pairing. But the thing is, there's other things to order besides samosa, tandoori chicken, and saag paneer, especially saag paneer. You can keep the samosas, but get rid of the saag paneer. That's another thing. I mean,
Colleen wrote a book about 14 years ago on how to order in an Indian restaurant. And we're talking about actually going to an Indian restaurant and organizing a meal that's off the beaten path. And it's going to be titled, and no tandoori chicken. Not that it's bad, it's not. But, you know, maybe expand your horizons. But let me get to the top. By the way, so with Colleen, with that 65, I've noticed there's other Indian Chinese dishes that also have that magical number 65.
Oh, there
for
are?
For whatever reason.
I don't know. I mean, have you seen that?
Yeah, I have.
Okay.
But don't worry, I'm not trying to stump the speaker.
No, it's fine. Probably it just sounded very catchy. Yeah.
How long has corn products been part of Indian cuisine?
Have what?
Corn products. Well, at least for sure, post-Columbian. Is there very much corn used?
Oh, corn. Oh, yeah, yeah, yes. Yeah. Corn came, of course, with the so-called Columbian exchange between, you know, the new and the old world. And yeah, I know it's very popular in, especially in North India. One of the iconic Punjabi dishes is this corn what's called maka roti, which is maka is Hindi for corn, with spinach, and that's a very common combination. So yeah, and they use coarse cornstarch as a thickening in some of these Chinese dishes. But yeah, you do have corn, especially in the north. Oh, and a very popular street food dish. I forgot to mention this. One of the most popular is roasted corn grilled kind of over a charcoal fire, and you eat it with a lot of butter, and you see it especially in the winter in North India, and it's really good. They put chili and sauce on it.
Would that be sweet corn or field corn?
Just sweet corn, yeah, corn okay. In the cob.
So what is Parsinda?
Pasinda, oh, she wrote it. It's pasinda. It's a long strip of meat. It's like maybe like eight inches long, and it's thin. And they that's the way that the meat is cooked, is cut for this particular kind of kebab.
Annette asked, Veeraswamy is the first Indian restaurant in London, so maybe they were the ones who produced the cookbook. I think it was talking about your cookbooks earlier.
No, it's, I don't know what the connection is. This cookbook is, it's really a little pamphlet. I don't know if there's any, there was no Veeraswamy to begin with. The guy who, then that is the oldest Indian restaurant, it may be the oldest Indian restaurant in the world, actually, but it's certainly the oldest one in the UK. I think it's about 90 years old. And it was founded by Edward Palmer. And Edward Palmer, I think, was the grandson of a Hyderabadi princess or something like that. And it was a very posh restaurant in the 1920s and 30s, and all the heads of state and kings would go there. And then it was bought by these sisters, the Punjabi sisters, and they've kind of updated, and it's still a very nice restaurant if you go to London. But this Veeraswamy with his cookbook, I don't even, and Veeraswamy was just a name they invented. There was no Veeraswamy. But this little cookbook, I mean, it's not like Mrs. Balbir Singh's. It's like a real little, tiny little thing, bad paper and stuff, but the recipes are really easy.
It was observed that Tarla Dalal has a YouTube channel.
Yes, she does. Yes.
Now, Annette said, I've been making Indian food at home for 30 years and learned a lot from the Manjula Jain, who lives in San Diego. Her techniques are efficient, and she makes a huge range of Indian vegetarian, all without garlic or onions, since she's a Jain. I don't know if you know her, but I remember fondly the Jane meal you arranged for us some years ago.
Yeah, that was great. Unfortunately, the guy, and this was a meal with no meat, no onions, no garlic, no root vegetables, but it was really good. Everyone agreed it was, and we had to do it a second time because people liked it so much. But unfortunately, the restaurant owner moved to New Jersey, so that was the end of that.
It sure was sad. I was just reading, Anne commented, she was just reading this fascinating book, The Last Jews of Kerala.
Oh.
I don't know if you've had that opportunity.
No, that sounds very interesting. I don't know the book.
Yeah. Bonnie and Brad said the first Indian restaurant they went to was Bengal Lancers on Clark Street in the late 60s. And it was the first place she had a Pimm's cup. I have my father's copy of the restaurant's cookbook. The restaurant's owner was a brother of one of my father's students. Okay. And she brings gulab jamun to a community seder.
That what?
Interesting. She brought gulab jamun?
Gulab jamun.
Yeah, well, that's my Indian pronunciation. Not quite authentic. Now, there was a question also about tiffins. If you might want to comment about their history and their use.
Oh, tiffin. Well, I mean, tiffin was a British word meaning, I think they used it, the Brits used it to mean lunch during the days of, you know, colonialism. And I think it just came to mean a light snack. So people talk about having like maybe a light tea time snack. To go back to Bengal Lancers. Yeah, the guy who owned that, Mohan Chablani, he was really a character. And he was a PR guy. And in the 1960s, there was the early Indian restaurants before Gaylords and things, they modeled themselves after kind of, they tried to be very British. So they would, there was some in the West Coast, so they would serve like, you know, British curries, and they would have Pimm's cup, and they would have, which was is kind of a, I think a gin drink with a mix. And they would have pictures of like hunting scenes and stuff like that. And so it was a really fancy restaurant. But then he died suddenly, I think, very young of a heart attack. So the restaurant closed down. And I have the cookbook, too.
Recommendations. So what is a good lunch buffet restaurant on Devine Avenue and not on Devine Avenue?
Oh, I don't know really. There's a really good one, a really big one, a huge one for $29 at Osmania on Devon. And they have, oh my gosh, they must have, it's only on Saturdays. I don't know if it's on Sundays. They have like 25, 30 dishes. It's just enormous. And that's really a good deal. I don't know about the other ones. They have it also on Nan Roti, where we go. They have that on Friday, but I looked at that. It didn't look too appealing. But this one, and those are the ones I'm familiar with. But, you know, so many restaurants have closed down. Like Tiffin is now under new ownership, and I don't know how they've changed that, if they still have. And then I think others have closed down on Devon. So it's really not as many as there used to be.
By the way, it was pointed out there's Paneer 65. Mm-hmm. Is one of those menu items. And then there was the Chinese restaurant 65 in Chicago. I don't know if it's still there, but I remember what the origin of that was. The guy had all these ambitions that he would open 65 Chinese restaurants. Okay. I'm not quite sure he ever got there. I don't think so.
Okay.
Somebody was fortunate to have a friend from Southern India teach them how to make the family's recipes for idli, dosa, vada, all from scratch.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's really something.
Yeah. Now, you don't have any loop downtown restaurants that's good for Indian food, do you?
You know, there are some, but I just, I don't go downtown, so I really don't know. I mean, Rue in, they have a new chef now. The problem with recommending a restaurant is you tell people, then the chef has moved and everything's changed. So it's really hard to kind of, to recommend them. So as far as going downtown to the Loop, I hardly ever go there, so I really can't make any recommendation.
Yeah, you know, I remember talking to the people from the Chinese American Museum, and they said the food is always steady if the owner is the chef. If the chef is a hired person, you could have a restaurant that's fantastic one day, and you come next time and it's just dreadful. Well, there's some additional things that have to do with, by the way, according to Annette, who is from the UK, she goes, Tiffin also means chocolate fridge cookies.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Instead of isn't it the stacked tins that are also referred to?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Tiffin carriers. Yeah.
You mentioned that sweet desserts are popular. Could you please elaborate on why that's so? People like it.
Well, sugar refining was actually invented in India. I've forgotten when. I mean, in really ancient times, sugar came. I mean, I think it was grown there. They were the first to refine it. Words like sugar. The word sugar comes from Sanskrit sakar. Words like candy come from there was a form of sugar, kind of a hard candy, a hard shape that comes from there. So sugar has always been a part of Indian life. The Indian middle class. I've heard has the biggest sweet tooth in the world. I mean, people eat a lot of sugar, and of course there's a lot of milk because of the cows. And so many sweets are made from milk and sugar in different forms. So it's just the history and the ingredients. And also, you know, if you're a vegetarian, this is a good way of getting protein and getting carbohydrates. And sugar is, and sweets are also considered ritually pure, so you can offer them to the gods and things like that. So they have a lot of functions.
Well, I think we've come right out of questions. However, I would like to point out something just because I think it's just Devine Avenue. I was completely unaware of when did it become Indian and Pakistani?
Oh, it became I think probably the 60s or probably the early 70s it started. Well, no, it would start. Okay, the immigration laws were, don't forget, in 1965, there was a major overhaul of immigration laws. Until then, U.S. immigration had been very Eurocentric. And then they just opened it up to skills. They ended the kind of the European preference. So a lot of people from South Asia came post 1965. So I think probably the early 70s is when it gradually started changing. And Devon Avenue is what's called a port of entry, which means, you know, when immigrants, they come to an an area that's not too expensive, where there's housing and things like that. And then gradually they get more wealthy and they move out. So I think now, like a lot of Indians have moved to Naperville, to Skokie, to Arlington Heights, you know, to all over the place. And then new groups will come in. Same thing with the Russian Jews that came in, they moved out. So there's always this constant change in Devon, which really makes it really interesting, you know, to live near here and to, you know, just walk around and see what's new there. There's always something new.
So I had relatives that lived near Devine Avenue, but we didn't visit each other too much. And I was in Moscow, USSR, and the people across the hall from me were from India, from Bombay, and they told me about Devine Avenue. I had no awareness of this. And in fact, the first time I ever had Bail Puri was when I went with them to Devine Avenue. So it's like, you know, and then I had a relative from New Zealand who came to visit and was totally frustrated that we kept calling it Devon Avenue.
Ah, yeah, Devon.
It's Devon. You know,
well, you know, Bail Puri is a really popular street food, and Indian street food is really popular. And you find it now, like if you go to a reception, a wedding or something, they'll have these street food, an Indian one, these street food kind of stalls, you know, where people will mix Bail Puri and things, you can mix your own. And now I just read the other day that the Indian government is debating whether to try and make Indian street food as a tourist draw. You know, because it really is amazing. And you know, you can go to a really fancy restaurant like Andean, and the first course will be a take on a street food, but a very, you know, elegant kind of, you know, beautifully presented take on a certain dish, on a chaat or something like that. So street food is really, really great. I mean, it's...
It actually could be one of those UNESCO cultural items to highlight. It's just fascinating. Anyway, Scott, I think it's your turn to say goodnight.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Colleen, and I want to end this talk on a sweet note. On one of your tours that I took, you took us on Devon Avenue to one of the places you took us, sold Indian sweets. It was just outstanding. Mm. What a revelation that was. And can you name that place?
Oh, yes, Sukadias, Sukadia, and it's on the corner of Rockwell and Devon. Mr. Sukadia's family have been sweet makers for nearly 150 years, and his sweets are really good. I just love them. They're they're about $1 each for a sweet, but it's really worth it. They're very subtle. And then during festivals, he has certain sweets that he only has certain times of the year. So, and our house is actually on Rockwell, so it's a few blocks away from his place. It's really great. And yeah, I think we did the tour. I think we stopped there. We met there, didn't we? And we had, walked around, and then we had lunch somewhere. And yeah.
Yeah. And thank you so much. I will always love tandoori chicken and samosas.
You could like them, but you just don't have to eat them all the time.
Right. And again, thanks to the tours that you give and other tours I've taken. And I would never eat vegetarian food because I always thought it's health food and it tastes terrible. And when I eat Indian vegetarian food, it is so satisfying and wonderful. What a revelation. I would never know that there's no meat in there. So anyway, that's my wonderful discovery about Indian food, that it is, well, it's some of the best food in the world. I'm not telling anybody anything new that they haven't heard, but it was quite a revelation after those terrible restaurants from the 50s. So anyway, good night. And
okay, thank you so much for inviting me. I really always enjoy it. Thank you.
Thanks,
and
you gotta
Colleen.
Come back
Be
again.
Good.
Come back again like you've done so many times.
Get sick of me.
You're okay. So prolific. Oh, I your library behind you, when I was talking to you yesterday, you've written so much, so I asked you, did you write all those books? But anyway, keep going and you'll have as many as you've got. Take care.
Okay. And by the way, we will, all the comments, Colleen will receive a copy of, so nobody's thoughts or opinions are lost. Thanks, Colleen.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody. See you next
week.
Good
night.
Week,
Thank
I hope.
You.
Good night.